have loved you anyway.
If you had just looked once or twice
and gone upon your quiet way,
they said that
happy holidays, and welcome again to F This Movie, the official podcast of FThisMovie.com. Movie love for movie lovers. My name is Patrick Bromley, and I'm super excited because it's time for this year's holiday show, which means I'm joined, as always, for this traditional episode by Adam Risky. Hey, Adam.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm okay. I'm sad that we don't get to do this in person. This is always one of the most fun shows to record.
Yeah, it feels a little weird under those circumstances, but we'll make do. We'll still kick Black Christmas, White Christmas's ass.
It's like a stain on our record.
Real men remember their failures.
Hopefully everybody is having a safe and happy holiday. We're just a few days away from Christmas. If you celebrate Christmas, we are past Hanukkah now, right?
Yeah,
Hanukkah's over, and but don't worry, Hanukkah's still gonna make an appearance on this episode.
Oh, cool.
Yeah,
I'm excited about it.
So whatever holiday you celebrate, hopefully you're safe and you're happy, and you're here with us listening to F This Movie, and we'll try to make your holiday a little bit brighter this year. We're having what we like to call a Travolta Cage Christmas, based on an episode that we did early this year, which is like my favorite episode that we've done in all of 2020, where we watched 5 DTV Travoltas and 5 DTV Cage movies. It was one of the last episodes we did in person before we went into lockdown and the pandemic has separated us, and we've been talking over Skype ever since. But it was certainly one of my favorite episodes that we did this entire year.
Yeah, it was really fun. I wanted to do a follow-up, but we're running out of Travolta DTVs.
True, although I did notice that The Poison Rose is on Amazon Prime, and it's directed by George Gallo, who directed one of the movies we're talking about tonight.
And according to IMDb trivia, people loved being directed by George Gallo.
He wrote the whole 10 yards.
Did he really?
Yeah. You know,
he is the director of Double Take.
He is. I saw Double Take in a theater.
I saw that at the Union.
Wow. I don't remember it. I don't remember liking it.
It wasn't worth the free that I paid.
I really like the whole 9 yards, and I really don't like the whole 10 yards, but it's been a long time since I saw it.
Yeah, I only saw the whole 9 yards, and then by the time the whole 10 yards came out, I think I had finals, and then who has the time?
Ever? Yeah, you're fine. You're fine. It was not good, is my memory of it. But before we get into our annual holiday episode, Adam Risky, have you seen anything good lately?
I've got a big list. So
all right, I'm excited.
Because I made it, and I checked it twice, and I'm going to tell you which of these movies are worth recommending. So the first one, I want to give like a grand jury prize for the first time for our holiday episode.
Wow.
I want to give a special shout out to Elfing Around, Joel Edmiston, our friend's feature film that he has on YouTube that everybody can watch. It is inspired manic craziness, and I watched it during breaks when I was stressed out while working, and it was perfect for that.
That's awesome. If you don't know, Joel is a friend of ours from Canada who made a movie using entirely like unlicensed music and all stock footage, and made a feature film out of it. And it's up on YouTube for free.
Yeah. I want to know from Joel how many pages the script was, because it's like dense, like the Meyerowitz story. A lot of stuff.
It's amazing that it's our first grand jury prize winner.
It is, yeah. But I think that, you know, we'll name it the Joel Edmiston Grand Jury Prize.
I like this.
And it's his namesake. So maybe next year we'll ask him, you know, for his advice on what should win the next Grand Jury Prize, because I think, you know, that's only appropriate. But yeah, good job, Joel. That's it looked like it took a lot of work, and it was really funny, just like you are. So it was a perfect approximation of the man who made the film.
Very nice. I'm super excited to try to check it out over break.
Yep. And then not as good, I revisited 2000's Loser, directed by Amy Heckerling.
Oh, man. Loser breaks my heart.
Yeah, I was very excited about that movie in 2000. And, you know, it had all the pedigree. It had Amy Heckerling. It had Biggs coming off of that Pie Heat.
Yeah.
It had Subari in her first kind of, like, co-bill, co-lead role.
Right, right.
And that movie is, like, 75% too mean. Like, the roommates are too mean. Greg Kinnear is too mean. And it's just sad. And it's not funny, although I'm not even sure how often it's trying to be funny. It's maybe I was just primed for it to be that because of Amy Heckerling and Jason Biggs. But it's a real downer. And I'm not a fan of it. And it ends with the creepiest post-credit ever, where there's this whole subplot about Mina Suvari wanting to sell her eggs in order to pay her tuition. And then at the end of the movie, it says, and she didn't have to sell her eggs, and Biggs has dibs on them. And that's how the movie ends.
Wow. Well, that's a happy ending for everyone.
No, not for her. Not for those eggs.
That's Amy Heckerling's, like, Clueless follow-up, isn't it?
Yeah, I
did
think
she
so.
Really not make a movie for 5 years? Wow.
Yeah. Not a good one.
No, because it doesn't, I don't know what it wants to say. I don't know what it's trying to be about. I don't fully have a handle on the Biggs character. I haven't seen it in a number of years. Say what?
Yeah, and like 90% of his problems would have been solved by just getting a haircut.
Which he does at the end, and it's like an obvious reshoot. I remember that.
Yeah, I don't know. But yeah, it I watched that the summer before I went to college, and I for a second there I was just like, oh no, is it going to be like this? And I'm like, oh wait, I'm not a loser. He's a loser.
Nice. Does it feature the song Teenage Dirtbag by Wheatus?
Yeah, it's all over the place.
That's what I remember from like the marketing was like featuring the song Teenage Dirtbag. I always think it's weird when a movie advertised that it featured a song as though you couldn't just hear it on the radio every hour.
Yeah, I mean, if you're in a pinch and you can't find Tal Bachman's High Above Me, Rent Loser, there's some Everclear in there, which, you know, I'll never kick an Everclear song out of bed, so it's okay.
No, it's kind of nice with an Everclear song. You always know what you're getting because it's the same song every time.
That is true. That is true. I kept rewatching 2000 stuff because for some reason in my brain, once January 1st hits, it's over. I can't watch anymore.
then you're done.
Then I'm done. So I took a dive. I finally watched an MGM HD staple when I used to have MGM HD, but I never watched Autumn in New York, directed by Joan Chen and starring in another May-December romance, Mr. Richard Gere.
Yeah.
And in this case, Winona Ryder. She has a terminal illness.
This movie came up once before on the podcast when we were talking about At First Sight, because we were talking about how they were kind of interchangeable.
It was, yeah. And I find it funny that, like, Gere is this womanizer, and he treats dating a woman with a terminal illness almost as, like, a value add. It's like, oh, good, you know. Move on at some point. It's a secret Christmas movie because, like, it ends around Christmas, although it doesn't end under the best circumstances for Winona Ryder. But she's weird in the movie because she's like, she's like 6 years removed from Little Women, and she's so good and so like just alive in that movie, no pun intended. And then in this one, she just seems like really disconnected, and she's playing like a 22-year-old woman, but it definitely has like that I'm playing Josh Baskin in Big as Tom Hanks thing going on.
Got it.
So it seems even more leechy of like Richard Gere. However, I'm just fascinated by Richard Gere as an actor. Like, he's the only person who like will read a script and be like, how many scenes am I just walking around New York moping? And then he'll sign on for that reason. He's like this restaurateur, but the only thing they ever show being served there are salads. So it's weird. There's like pasta salad and regular salad, and it's probably a Let Us Entertain You restaurant. And the dumbest restaurant ever. And then Winona Ryder makes these hats that like looks like children would make them, where it's got like the Blade Runner like you turn on it, but it's attached to like wire that you just stick on your head, and you look like one of the kids from Signs trying to ward off the aliens. It's strange. I don't get it. And then there's like this whole thing where Richard Gere was friends with Winona Ryder's mom, and then Winona Ryder's mom used to like him, and then Winona Ryder asked her grandma, like, hey, why didn't my current boyfriend get together with mom?
Oh, boy.
And then Elaine Stritch is, like, the grandma, and she's just like, your mother loved Richard Gere, but he shacked up with her doubles partner, and she caught them on the cabana at the fall clam bake. And I'm like, what fucking what? Movie am I
watching? Wow.
So, I don't know. It's a real weird movie.
It sounds very rich and white. Of course you kind of liked it.
Yeah, it's definitely rich and white. I kind of want Richard Gere to keep making these movies where he gets older, but the girl stays the same age. And like maybe Dua Lipa is like the new girlfriend and he's like 70 years old. Or, wow. Like, he'll wait till he's 80, and then, like, he'll do a romantic drama with Billie Eilish or something. Like, let's try this out. Let's keep going, Richard.
I mean, even in Pretty Woman, they're, like, 20 years apart, and it's never acknowledged.
No. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, she seems – because she was, like, yeah, in her early 20s, and she seems a little bit older, and he kind of seems – yeah, like, I don't know. It doesn't seem as bad. Like, it still fits maybe under the half plus seven rule, but this is way out the window now.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. Yeah. I never saw it because I generally try to avoid terminal illness movies, although I've seen more than my share.
Yeah, I don't know. Do you think they only exist because of Love Story?
I mean, that's probably not the only reason. Somebody would have stumbled upon it eventually. A room full of monkeys with typewriters would have eventually accidentally written a terminal illness movie. But I'm sure that Love Story played a big part in kickstarting a trend, yeah.
Yeah. There's so many dumb lines in this movie, too, where it's like he dances with her. He goes, you don't dance, you float.
Mm.
And then there's another line where she asks him why food, like why he's a restaurant owner. And he says something, I can't remember the exact line, but he's just like, it's the only form of love that's also nourishment.
Oh, I'm like, God. Get out of like, here.
It's like, eat my salad, motherfuckers.
Barf. Oh, my God. You have not talked to me into seeing this movie, which I know is your goal.
Yeah, I didn't achieve my goal then. yeah, it's the first romaine tick.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, there it goes. And that ball went straight out of the ball.
Grand jury prize for that joke.
I also watched The Godfather Coda, The Death of Michael Corleone.
Yes.
And it's interesting. Like, it, I feel like if they released this version in 1990, it probably would have been more accepted than the one that actually did go out, because it sort of dials back. They're still alive. It sort of dials back like the Vatican stuff, and it feels more like a Godfather movie. And this one I described, I think, to you as like the grindhouse version of Godfather 3.
Right.
So
scene missing.
Yeah, yeah. So it's, and they move scenes around, and like the ending has like a completely different connotation. Not like the climax ending, but like the final scene where they show like old man Michael Corleone.
Where he like slumps over in the chair.
Yeah, yeah. So I don't want to spoil it. I could tell
it's literally called The Death of Michael Corleone.
I have to tell you about it after the show. Like, I don't want to spoil it for people who are going to watch it, but like the title might be misleading.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, they try something, and like it's
revealed that he's a Terminator.
Yeah, he's a good Terminator. Yeah. No, he's a bad Terminator. Vito was the good Terminator.
Oh God, I forgot. And I forgot good Terminator, bad Terminator already. It's been so long since Hillbilly Elegy.
And his children were the neutrals. So, Godfather Code is
come like, if you, from the future.
I need your keys, your car, and your clothes. I'm going out tonight.
Anyway, sorry, you were saying.
Let's find John Connor. So, yeah, if you like Godfather 3, I think it's good as a curiosity. I would still watch Godfather 3 if I'm watching the trilogy, you know, next time around. So
I was really excited when it was announced, because I'm fascinated by the idea of Coppola going back and recutting his movie and turning it into something else. But it really does sound just like sort of an abridged version of The Godfather 3. And A, I don't know Godfather 3 well enough to know exactly what the differences are. And B, I don't know that I'm interested in a version that's just shorter.
Yeah. Well, they move this. Yeah, and they move scenes around so that, like, the opening of the movie is, like, Michael talking to the Archbishop. And if I remember correctly, that scene in the original version doesn't happen until, like, an hour into the movie. So, I don't know. It's weird. Like I said, curiosity.
Okay.
And then I watched The Last Blockbuster, the documentary about Blockbuster Video's history and the last remaining store in Bend, Oregon, which I really want to visit at some point, but then I have to figure out what else to do in Oregon. No offense to the people who live in Oregon, but what I see is there's not a lot going on in Bend, but who knows? Maybe I'll go there one day. But the documentary itself is fun. It's not like anything. It's like a real pop doc type of thing. Yeah. Where like it's trying to say, like, don't you love Blockbuster? And there's like only Lloyd Kaufman saying, I don't love Blockbuster. Which I know a lot of other people don't love Blockbuster. And it's very much like, you know, hey, ignore you just fawning over like this conglomerate that like put a lot of businesses out of work and everything like that. But there's an anecdote that Paul Scheer has where he used to work at Blockbuster, and he did a prank at his Blockbuster that I did at my Blockbuster. So I was just like, whoa, it's kind of a no-brainer if you work there long enough, like you just figure out like, yeah, I should probably do this. But he would also crawl into the Dropbox and rip movies out of people's hands and scare them. And I just felt very, you know, like...
Validated.
Thank you. I was about to say verified, but that's not what I got.
Yeah, you got the blue check mark.
Yeah, I got the blue check mark, the golden blue Blockbuster check mark for it. But, you know, I really loved working there. So, like, I liked it from a nostalgia perspective. So it was a fun watch. It'll either be, like, number 2, number 10, an honorable mention, or not on my top 10 list at all.
One of those.
Yeah. did you watch The Princess Switched Again?
No, because we decided we weren't doing it for our holiday show. And then that freed me up to never have to watch it.
All right, I'm going to tell you two things about it to see if this wins you over.
All right.
One, this is Vanessa Hudgens' Dr. Strangelove.
Not doing it yet.
And then Kevin is better in this movie. It's like he listened to our show and just like, I got to dial it back a little bit.
I mean, I only half remember like what that's in reference to. I remember the actor and I remember us saying he gives a crazy performance, but I don't even remember what was crazy about it. I can't even really picture the actor.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, yeah, I watched Christmas Chronicles 2. Did you watch that?
My kids did. I was kind of in and out of the room.
Okay.
Yeah, it seemed overly complicated.
It was very busy. It was like overstuffed, like in a Revenge of the Fallen way that I didn't understand. I was just like, guys, calm down a little bit. There wasn't enough Tyrese in it. He was just in it at the beginning and at the end.
Tyrese as Bob. I saw all of his scenes.
Well, you saw the stuff that counts. But I was disappointed that Oliver Hudson didn't come back as the dad trapped in the ornament.
Inside his glass prison.
Because if, since Kimberly Williams Paisley is now with Tyrese, it could have been like a whole Breaking the Waves situation.
Oh, I've never seen Breaking the Waves.
It's basically like the man's incapacitated, so he asks his wife to like take on lovers and tell him about it.
Oh, that sounds sexy.
So, I mean, maybe something to think about for Christmas Chronicles 3, Chris Columbus.
It's Lars von Trier, right? You know that's sexy.
Yeah, Lars von Trier's Christmas,
Christmas Chronicles 3.
Melon Chronicles.
The world is ending, and Santa wants Mrs. Klaus to take the lovers.
And on Christmas Eve, it all blows up. So yeah, that's what I've been watching. So some good stuff, some fun stuff.
Yeah. All right. Any other like 2000 recommendations?
Oh boy.
Any that didn't make the 2K replay cut?
Well, there were a few that I wanted to kind of binge that I didn't get around to, like 13 Days, Traffic, The Contender.
I like The Contender.
I like it too. Wonder Boys is very good.
Yeah.
So In the Mood for Love. So there's some stuff. I might have to go back after the holidays to backtrack a little bit. Although I'm very excited about continuing the column for the 2001 movies, because there's a lot of good ones. I think my first one will be Lord of the Rings or Antitrust.
Well, no disparity there. I like that. I've never seen Antitrust, I don't think. Or maybe I have, and it's completely forgettable. I mean, I remember, like, it's Ryan Phillippe and Claire Forlani and Tim Robbins and possibly Rachel Lee Cook. Do I have that right?
Yeah, yeah, you got all the cherries on the slot machine.
Okay, good.
Yeah, and Tim Robbins plays like evil Bill Gates.
Right.
And it's like Lord of the Rings in the sense that's the first of a trilogy and that there's a theatrical and extended edition.
I still haven't seen the extended version. Damn it.
It's good. It's got more Forlani.
Antitrust Coda, The Death of Claire Forlani.
Oh man, so good.
R.I.P. So
I really like, I'm like, why is this open with Bill Gates talking to the Archbishop?
Yeah, I've also never seen 13 Days, and I feel terrible about that because I know it's good and it's got your boy Costner in it.
I could loan it to you. We could do like a proto Netflix thing where like I just drive over and leave it in your mailbox.
Oh, that would be great. Thanks. Is everybody in that movie doing, like, era voices? Because I don't know if I can take it.
100,000%, yes.
Yeah, see, my head will explode watching it.
Kevin Costner is... He sounds like Elmer Fudd, unfortunately, in that movie. He almost sounds like the parody of era voice that you guys do, but, like, worse.
Yeah, that's why I don't know if I can handle seeing that movie.
Yeah, I don't know. It's super good though. Like once you get the hang of it, it's like Autumn of New York.
It's it was like a rare New Line miss for me in those days. I saw every New Line movie, but I didn't see that one for some reason.
Yeah, that's like they should have, like in 2000, if they did like a New Line Max where it all was streaming, and they released every movie on New Line Max, you would have watched every one except for 13 Days.
Basically, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, both of us have been exploring HBO Max now that we both upgraded to Amazon Fire Sticks so that we could watch HBO Max, and then like a week later it was announced that it would be on the Roku, so much for our, you know, wise purchasing decisions. But I'm happy with the Amazon Fire Stick, and I've been exploring it a little, and it's crazy because there's so many movies on there that, like, I will pull something up that I want to watch, and then below it's got like, and here's five other recommendations, and I also want to watch those five.
Yeah.
I'm never leaving my house again, which is good because we're in a pandemic. I don't leave the house already.
Exactly. Yeah. I just go out to get food, so I have stuff to eat while I watch more stuff on Amazon Fire Stick. My only gripe with it so far is that if you play something on Amazon Music, it will play in the background until you start something else that also like has audio. So sometimes I'm just like, oh God, it was a bad idea to re-listen to What's the Story, Morning Glory, and I just want it to turn off. Like when I hit back, I'm like, back means stop. Keep going endlessly. Anyways, yeah. I don't know. Are you an Oasis fan?
I like that album.
Yeah, it is a good album.
Yeah. I've liked some other stuff. I don't know that I would call myself an Oasis fan.
Okay.
But, I mean, I definitely like Live Forever, and I liked the album that came out after What's the Story, Morning Glory, which I can't remember the title of that album, but I liked it.
They had a song on the Faculty soundtrack that was good.
They have a song on the Life Less Ordinary soundtrack.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I need to rewatch it because I saw you tweeted something about it.
Yeah, a rare tweet for me. I like that movie a lot.
Yeah. I had a Noel Gallagher haircut when I was 14.
Wow.
Inspired by Oasis, yeah.
Did you also get yourself a brother that you hated?
Yeah, did you see him around?
I've got a couple movies that I can talk about. We watched Arch Enemy, the new Adam Egypt Mortimer movie starring Joe Manganiello as a guy who is kind of like a homeless guy who claims he's from another dimension, where in his dimension he was a superhero, but he like traveled through a black hole to Earth, where he wants to fight crime, but he's instead just like a grouchy homeless guy. And I really liked Adam Egypt Mortimer's last movie, which was called Daniel Isn't Real, which I think is still streaming on Shudder if you haven't seen it. It was one of my favorite horror movies of last year. I liked Arch Enemy. I didn't quite love it. It uses a lot of like animation to get around some budgetary stuff, which I understand, but it was just an aesthetic choice that didn't quite work for me. He's a really interesting filmmaker, and I'm excited that he's making more movies, because I know you and I were both very mixed to negative on his first movie, Some Kind of Hate, which had a great concept, and then the execution, I don't want to speak for you, but the execution didn't work for me.
Yeah, I remember it starting really well, and then by the end I wasn't as into it as I began.
Yeah, I mean, the concept alone, it's this girl who like wears a razor blade necklace, and she's like into self-harm, and so she's cutting up all these people who are in like they're at like a camp for mentally disturbed teenagers, and it's talking about so many things that are so relevant, and then it just kind of didn't do much with it. But Daniel Isn't Real is really good, and Arch Enemy is probably, for me, somewhere in between. I like Joe Manganiello as an actor, and he certainly commits. I think he's a producer on the movie, too. Amy Simons shows up, which is always welcome, and they have a really great scene together at the end of the movie. There's some really cool stuff in it. It's a sort of a mild recommend for me. If it was streaming for free right now, I would say absolutely watch it. Maybe wait till it shows up on Shudder or something like that.
Okay. Sounds good.
A movie I liked even less is Ava, starring Jessica Chastain. Man, I heard about this movie. I saw a poster. It's like Jessica Chastain as an assassin holding a gun, and I couldn't have been more on board, because I'm a very, very big fan of Jessica Chastain. and I like movies about assassins, but my gosh, has this movie been made so many times before and better. There's a lot of Haywire DNA in it. Not that it's okay to talk about Haywire anymore, but that movie still exists and we have to acknowledge it, right? I'm kidding about that. People who are now offended that I would make a joke about Haywire, but Gina Carano is who she is. So there's a lot of Haywire DNA in it. John Malkovich plays like her handler, sort of in the Bill Paxton role, even though he was her dad. And Colin Farrell is sort of the Ewan McGregor role. And it's just so generic. It's been done so many times, but what makes it sort of inexcusable is the fact that the action is so poorly done and so badly shot. I can't remember an action movie with worse action that I've seen in a long, long time. It was really, really bad.
Yeah, that seems about on par with everybody who's watched it has said. Like, I wanted to see it, and I even rented it, and then I just was warned off on it, and then Scary Movie Month happened, and I just was like, whatever, I'm not going to watch it. It was like that Cole Hauser wrestling movie. I just couldn't do it.
I rented it from a Redbox, which seemed about right, and didn't get around to watching it, so I returned it, and then a couple weeks later it showed up on Netflix, so we watched it that way. And yeah. I can't even recommend it as a free watch on Netflix. It is just not good. Even though, you know, I got to watch Jessica Chastain for 90 minutes, but it's in a really bad movie, unfortunately.
Watch the Salome movies. You could watch her for 3 hours.
I might just do that. Your column did not talk me out of it, by the way.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, the header image, I should say, didn't talk me out of it.
Yeah.
I saw Nomadland, which is a new film from Chloe Zhao that I think is getting limited release before the end of the year or maybe in January. I'm guessing it'll go to VOD, but it stars Frances McDormand as a woman who her town basically suffered total economic collapse. Her husband passed away and she just hit the road in a van, and that's how she lives her life now. She just travels from city to city. She finds little part-time gigs. She works for a while, she moves on, she travels to the next city. And it's a weird mix of documentary and narrative feature because most of the people she interacts with the exception of like David Strathairn, who plays a fellow nomad, they seem to be real people who are living this lifestyle, and they're all credited as their first names. You know, they're not necessarily actors playing parts. They're kind of all playing themselves. Really beautifully shot, not a ton of story, but really interesting in that it's, like I said, almost a documentary exploring the subject through the lens of a narrative feature film. But I thought it was really good. I know it's picking up a lot of like critics' awards and getting named on a lot of 10 best lists. The Chicago Film Critics Awards have not announced their winners as of this recording, but I suspect it'll do very well at the Chicago Film Critics Awards that are getting announced. Well, by the time this comes out, they will have been announced, but it's a good movie. People should be on the lookout for it.
I want to see it. This year is weird because, you know, under normal circumstances, like some of these movies I could see in theaters, but like Nomadland, News of the World, Promising Young Woman, One Night in Miami, Minari, like they're not coming out to like January or February or maybe even later on streaming. So I feel like my list will, I feel like the last blockbuster will benefit.
Straight to number two.
Yeah. Straight to number two.
There's one more movie that we'll talk about, but before we get to that, I want to talk about a movie that's now getting, it appears, the little I've checked in on social media. Seems like a lot of people are talking about this movie now because people are finally able to see it. And that is Tenet, the Christopher Nolan movie that was meant to save cinema. You were the only person I knew that kind of saw it theatrically, although you saw it more in like a drive-in setting in a movie theater parking lot because drive-ins weren't allowed to book it, I don't believe, because Christopher Nolan has very specific ideas about what a movie is and isn't, and a drive-in does not fit under those parameters. But being projected in a movie theater parking lot apparently is okay. So now that it's on Blu-ray and DVD and digital purchase, not even digital rental, people are finally seeing it and weighing in, and most of the reactions I've seen have been negative, although there were a few very positive comments in our weekend thread from people who were seeing it for the first time. I'm in the middle on the side of liking it. And I think some of that has to do with the movies that I've been seeing lately, because I'm supposed to vote in this awards group. I've been seeing a very specific kind of movie over and over and over for the last few weeks. And so the opportunity to see Tenet, which is just a big, expensive Hollywood science fiction action movie, was kind of a breath of fresh air. And I enjoyed it on that level. I understand most of the criticisms. It has no real story. It kind of has a setup, and it's nothing but characters explaining things to one another and delivering exposition to each other. The main character doesn't even have a name. He's just called the protagonist. But I really liked John David Washington in the movie, and I was watching it as... I know Christopher Nolan is a big James Bond fan, so I was kind of watching it as Christopher Nolan's Bond film, which I know he kind of already did in Inception. There was like the whole skiing sequence and stuff in Inception that felt like his take on a Bond movie, but I felt like this even more was his take on a Bond movie with John David Washington as Bond and Elizabeth Debicki as the Bond girl and Robert Pattinson as sort of the Felix Leiter. And Kenneth Branagh doing a Bond villain. That's sort of that was the way in for me, was seeing what Kenneth Branagh was doing as the villain of the movie. He's doing a total Bond villain performance. I thought the special effects were cool. I thought it looked great. I thought it sounded great. You know, again, it's a lot of nonsense and it's utterly humorless. And that's where it differs from a Bond movie, because Bond movies generally have a sense of fun. And this, you know, Christopher Nolan is not a fun guy at all. So it had no sense of fun to it, but I had fun watching it.
That's good. Yeah, I liked certain things in it. Like I liked John David Washington and Robert Pattinson. I thought that the movie was at its best when they were together on screen. And I liked some of the locations, like the whole stuff with the sailing in Italy was gorgeous to look at. And I thought the score was really good. It wasn't Hans Zimmer. It was Ludwig Göransson, kind of doing a Hans Zimmer
right.
kind of tribute score. But I thought that was really good. For me, it was just I was bored. And especially after the highway stuff, like around the middle of the movie, when I saw there was like another hour left, I was just like, I'm like worn out. Like, I'm just not – I don't know. Because for me – I understand like what you're saying, like about the spy element to it, but such a joy of those Bond movies is the fantasy of like, wouldn't it be cool to vicariously live this experience? And as you said, you know, this is just not fun at all. And like, I would rather like go to work than like do what this guy's doing in this movie. So, I found it to be kind of a drag. It was, something where the first time I saw it, when I was still trying to kind of piece it together, even though I was watching it in a parking lot, and it was very difficult to see and to hear and stuff. It wasn't a good way to watch that movie at all. I was still a little invested in it. But when I watched it at home this week, it was really bothering me that like I understood what was happening, but I didn't understand why they were doing any of what they were doing. Why did they think, you know, say they have a plan to execute. It's like, why did they choose this plan? Or like there was just no space for that. Although there's so much talking that there should be space for it. So I don't know. I feel like Nolan's just a really difficult storyteller, almost on purpose. And I wish that he wasn't.
Yeah, I think the movie, given what it's about, and given the twists that are introduced, and, you know, each of those would kind of perk me up. And I can't say that they pay off as well as I would like them to. But given the structure of this movie, I don't even want to say what it is, but it's within a genre of movies that I really like. I'm a big fan of this type of movie. and some of the other entries in this kind of movie are among my favorite movies of all time. It should be almost airtight. It should be almost a narrative closed loop. And I think that's what he's trying for. I've only seen it once. Maybe if I watched it again, I would say, oh yeah, it really is a lot tighter than I initially recognized. But I don't know that it is upon first viewing, you know. So it goes to what you're saying, which is like there's all these questions that you have that you don't totally understand. I don't know that the movie provides satisfying answers to those questions.
Yeah. I will say, though, it was nice watching just an action movie because I went back to watch Birds of Prey and Bad Boys for Life just because I miss action movies. Right. And like for, you know, since February through, you know, now, like nothing, unless you count, you know, Extraction or The Old Guard, but like those aren't real movies.
Easy, Christopher Nolan.
I apologize to the fans of those movies, but like come on.
Extraction has that single take. Come on.
The thing that's more impressive about Extraction for me is that the end credits are like 15 minutes long. Like, cause I remember it said it was like 2 hours and then the movie ended and it would said like an hour 42. And I'm like, what's going to happen for the next 18 minutes? And I just sat there just dutifully watching all the credits. I mentioned this in a column I did with Rob. One thing that I think is kind of neat in a weird way is, you know, with Soul and Wonder Woman 84 coming out on streaming on Christmas Day, they feel like events in a way that they wouldn't if it was just Soul came out in June and Wonder Woman came out in August.
Right.
So I don't know. I need to find a way to make it even more so. Like maybe I'll do a midnight and I'll stand outside my apartment to get in.
I like this plan.
Yeah, I'll get like a tent or a sleeping bag.
I'm sure that had a big role to play in my enjoyment of Tenet because all of my viewing lately has been, you know, First Cow this and Ma Rainey that. And it's like I just needed a break and Tenet was the break that I was looking for. Even though I think it wants to be kind of very serious adult science fiction, I definitely was watching it more of like popcorn action entertainment. And on that level, I enjoyed it.
I hear you. Yeah. I liked the First Cow and the Ma Rainey, but
it's not even that I didn't like them, but it's just at one after another of those kinds of movies, it just starts to become numbing.
Yeah. Yeah. I totally know what you mean. You know what's not numbing?
I can only imagine.
Love Lights Hanukkah.
So for those of you who maybe are hearing a holiday episode for the first time every year, not every year, I don't know when this started with the Amy Smart movie, right?
No, it was, so in
wasn't that the first time we did like the,
I think, yes. Yes, yeah, okay. The 12 Dates of Christmas was year three of the holiday episodes, but it was our first Spotlight Showcase holiday movie.
Thank you for having a name for it. Last year's Spotlight Showcase holiday movie, of course, Miracle at Half Court, is that right? Half Court Miracle.
Full Court Miracle.
Full Court, oh God. I
the director is shaking his head so hard.
I'm so sorry. Full Court Miracle. And this year's holiday spotlight, no, shoot, what is it?
Our Flim Flam Flick Jam.
I already forgot. Our spotlight holiday movie is Love Lights Hanukkah, which premiered a week ago.
Stocking stuffer.
It premiered a week ago on the Hallmark Channel. Now, I should say I am not the audience for this movie because I am not a fan of the Hallmark Netflix Freeform Lifetime whatever. I feel like there's so many channels now that devote themselves entirely to this type of Christmas movie. I don't care. I don't care for the aesthetics of them. I don't care for most of the stories. It's just not a thing that I'm into. We have a column that runs in December. Adam and Allison watch holiday movies, devoted entirely to these kinds of movies. So if you are a fan, I highly recommend that you check that column out. So take my words on Love Lights Hanukkah with a grain of salt is all I'm saying. Kosher salt.
This movie's great. I don't know what you're talking about. I told you while I was watching it that this is like the Hallmark movie that Jewish people have been waiting for, because we're slowly almost getting our own movie. Like, they'll still have a bit of Christmas in there to hedge their bets.
Yeah.
But this is the closest to Black Panther that we've ever gotten. This movie, how do I describe it? I should probably explain the plot, because we shouldn't take for granted that everybody knows the plot of Love Lights Hanukkah.
No, absolutely not.
The movie stars Mia Kirshner of the Black Dahlia, The L Word, Exotica, The Crow.
Not another City teen movie?
Not another teen movie. So she has a type of movie and show that she's usually in, and a lot of it is like kind of erotically charged. So to see her in the Hallmark like G-rated sweet movie, it's always like you're expecting the other shoe to drop, but yeah. It never does.
No, she got a weird Amy Adams makeover.
Yeah. So she's the lead. And then her romantic interest is Ben Savage from Boy Meets World, who still looks like he's maybe like 1 year removed from Boy Meets World.
Yep.
He doesn't look like a grown up yet. He looks like 13 going on 30 a little bit. And he plays a food critic, and he has given so Mia Kirshner owns an Italian restaurant, and she's Christian. She's adopted. She finds out through an ancestry DNA test that she's half Jewish and half Italian, so half European Jewish and half Italian. Her mother, her adopted mother, has passed away. So she is using the ancestry DNA to find her biological mother and father. It leads her to Mary Lou Henner, who is her biological mother. And Ben Savage, the food critic, is a friend of the family, and he just so happens to have given Mia Kirshner's restaurant a negative review in the past. He says that her lasagna is predictable, which I bullshit on, because lasagna is a food that you want to be predictable.
Surprise, lasagna.
Because when it's fucking unpredictable, that's when you get burnt ends from an encore meal, like in your stove, and yeah. Yeah, it's unpredictable, but yeah, it's also inedible. So thank you, Benson. This movie is romantic as fuck. Mia Kirshner and Ben Savage make a weird couple, but it's kind of like that weird tension that you want in a romantic comedy.
Okay.
Although I shouldn't call it a comedy, because I don't think it ever goes for laughs.
No.
Also Mary not a drama. Mary Lou Henner's introduced polishing a dreidel so that we know that she's Jewish.
There's so much Jewish explaining in this movie. Like,
yeah,
I don't know. It's very weird. I remember a little bit of this from Full Court Miracle, too, where it's like, it assumes that you know nothing about Judaism, or that you have never met a Jewish person. Like, it there's an othering that takes place in these movies, even though they're made with the opposite intent.
I agree with that. I will say, though, these type of people exist where they know nothing about Jewish culture whatsoever. So like when I was at school in Indiana, when I was a freshman and I had mentioned something about Hanukkah, like a lot of people didn't get what I was talking about at all. Like the people who were from Indiana or from, you know, like non-Chicago or New York, they were like really confused that I didn't still celebrate Christmas. And I'm like, no, it's like a different religion. And then they're just like, what's this? And I'm like, it's snow.
A dreidel, like, you say?
A certain, yeah, it's like, is that for conjuring spells? No, it's not.
A menorah what? That's the sequel to Love Lights Hanukkah.
Fun times, yeah. But now that we got Kirshner and Savage, like, I want to see, like, this is their Joe versus the Volcano, and I want to see two more of these. Yeah. There's some good lines in this, like, Mia Kirshner at one point asked Ben Savage, how do you know so much about lasagna and ancient Greece? And that's just a good line of this. It's good writing.
Right there. What amazed me about this movie is that it is entirely without conflict.
Yeah, you're right.
There is not a conflict in this movie. No one. There's not even the attempt at a conflict. There are no misunderstandings. No one gets their feelings hurt at any point. even the thing about, like, you gave my restaurant a bad review is never really a plot point. It's just something that's mentioned.
That part pissed me off because, like, they sort of have, like, this mea culpa, like, lunch together. And he says, he's like, oh, I'm sorry I called your lasagna predictable. And then she goes, it's okay. My mother had just died, so I didn't put my heart into it. I'm like, no, you stick up for your goddamn lasagna.
Yeah. Right? And if anything, like, shouldn't that make him feel worse about the review that he wrote? Like, her mom just died.
You think so? I don't know. But Ben Savage plays this part like he's been waiting for this life. Like, this is like his Tony Stark. he's just ready. Like, he's in his element.
He's going to be the keystone of the Love Lights Hanukkah shared cinematic universe.
Let's hope that happens, yeah.
Where all the characters from the other movies eat at Mia Kirshner's restaurant.
How does Mia Kirshner pay for things, Patrick?
Oh my gosh, it's so great. It's just, she just goes, oh, I'll take three, thanks. And she just hands a bill of unknown denomination to the person. They don't look at it. There's no change dealt with. It's literally just like, here, it's just a note that says, this is money. And it happens more than once in the movie.
Yeah, and the second time it happens, she pays in, like, it looks like a rolled up cigarette. I don't like know. She just rolls up the money, which is pretty great. Yeah,
it's just a bizarre universe that this movie takes place in.
It's very weird. Her biological father apparently is imprisoned in the kitchen because every one of the scenes is just him answering the phone in a kitchen.
But he's Italian.
And I like how Mia
Kirshner, you're my daughter.
So her dad's name is Giorgio, and like Mary Lou Henner was the mother. So like her and Giorgio had Mia Kirshner. So Mary Lou Henner asked Ben Savage, she's like, how do you find Giorgio's number? And he goes, look, it took a little bit of research and a good friend in the Italian army. You know, like everybody just has, you know, good friend. And
what war friendly. Are we fighting right now that he has friends in the Italian army?
Yeah, I don't know at all. And then I found it very unsettling that, like, everyone is just watching this blooming romance and, like, they don't want any privacy at all.
No.
Like, you just expect them to just start, like, doing it on, like, the Christmas Eve table.
No,
like, right
there at... This is a sexless world.
Yeah, I don't know. But, I mean, for me, it was sexy because it was, you know, like, nothing better than a Hanukkah crush. You know what I'm talking about? I want to talk about the scene where she's giving her new family presents because... it's ridiculous. Like, she gives her stepsister two jerseys, a basketball, and floor seats to the Cavaliers, and then she gives her mother another dreidel.
Yeah, but it's a beautiful dreidel.
Yeah. And then she said,
and then says something like, I don't know what Jewish people like. That's not what she says, but that's the implication. Yeah.
And then
I didn't know what to get a Jewish person.
Yeah. I don't know. It's like, what normal stuff do you get? Right. Yeah. And then she says that somebody asked her, they're just like, how did you score these floor seats to the Cleveland Cavaliers? And she goes, the general and manager are customers at my restaurant. Okay. Let me break this down. There's a general manager There's a coach.
Right.
There's no manager, and then some weird military general is part of a basketball organization.
She had a friend in the Italian army.
Yeah, I don't know. And then it's just weird to me, too, that this is like the most eventful Hanukkah for any person that's ever happened since the first Hanukkah. Like, she finds a brand new family and a new love in 8 days.
Yeah. What were like your feelings on I'm choking on my drink here. What were your feelings on 8 Crazy Latkes?
It was that like their thing where they were just naming like chocolate latke.
Yeah, he was
like that.
The brother, her new brother works at a deli, and so I knew that the movie had you at that point, because any any kind of deli representation, Adam's on board. And he's doing a series of latkes called 8 Crazy Latkes. And so there's like a guaca latke.
Yeah.
Choco latke.
It reminded me of the Canadian deli guy in the documentary Deli Man. So this reference is universal. So everybody will get this. But there was he was always about like Jewish fusion with food. And I'm just like, pump your brakes, asshole. Like, nobody wants this shit. Like, nobody wants a fucking guacalaca.
Like, it all sounded gross to me.
Yeah, just get applesauce or sour cream, motherfucker.
Right.
Just like, you know,
do the traditional.
Hands on home,
yeah.
On home key. Let's go. Like, I don't know. Anyways, but I did think that, you know, it made sense to me that Ben Savage is a Jewish man. The moment he starts dating somebody who celebrates Christmas, you hang on for dear life, because I've been like, even if the relationship is bad, you gotta hang on.
You gotta hang in there for the Christmas.
You gotta hang in there for at least 2 Christmases. Because I remember back in 2002 when I had my first Christmas and I went over to my girlfriend's family Christmas, and it was like a sense of discovery, and everybody was like 75% laughing with me, 25% laughing at me, and I wouldn't trade it for the world.
Anything else about Love Lights Hanukkah, except that it's on your honorable mention list?
Yeah, number 2, number 10 are honorable. one of those. I haven't decided yet.
I was, you know, happy to watch it for the purposes of this podcast, but I was not really into it. But again, I don't have a ton of experience with these kind of made-for-TV, made-for-cable holiday movies. I'm looking at the director's resume. Did you look at that at all?
No. Who directed it?
Mark Jean, a guy who does a lot of TV. Sometimes he makes 4 to 5 movies a year with titles like Flip That Romance, A Veteran's Christmas, The 9 Lives of Christmas, Mom's Day Away, The Christmas Ornament, Finding a Family, 3 weeks, 3 kids, Come Dance at My Wedding. So he works like crazy and makes a lot of TV. He started in episodic television and now makes like 4 to 5 TV movies a year. So I'm not well versed. Oh, go ahead.
Do you think like on the Trimark lot that Mark Joan and Mark Jean have like adjoining offices?
Like, yeah, you want to go over by Joan and Jean. Jones and Jean.
Everything. He's trying to make it more Jewish.
How do we decide who gets which office? I'll tell you what. I'll take the smaller one.
I just need
a cubicle.
How do we attract that Selena Gomez? Guacalaca.
Love Lights Hanukkah. They had to have spent, I don't know, 3 seconds on that title.
I always keep wanting to call it Lights Camera Hanukkah. I don't know why.
Better title, yeah. Honestly. Although it wouldn't really play into, nobody's making a movie, you know, because it takes place in the world of fine Cleveland dining.
Better or worse than Full Court Miracle?
I probably enjoyed watching it more because I like the actors. you know, Mia Kirshner and Ben Savage and Mary Lou Henner. And I like the genre of like romance better than I do sports movie. But I don't know that it's a better movie necessarily.
Better or worse than Mank?
Better.
You heard it here.
Mank. Oh, God.
It's like Hallmark proudly presents the film that Patrick Bromley says is better than Mank. Love Lights, Hanukkah.
Yeah, that's fine. I would rather watch 12 Dates of Christmas before any of them, though. That was certainly my favorite of the ones we've done so far.
Yeah, I think we reached the apex mountain.
Yeah.
Of the stocking stuffer cinematic movie. What do we call this again?
I don't remember.
Spotlight Showcase.
Spotlight Showcase holiday movie.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's get into our main topic for the evening, for the 2020 holiday episode, which is A Travolta Cage Christmas. We watched three John Travolta, Nicolas Cage Christmas movies. We watched Look Who's Talking Now. We watched Trapped in Paradise. And we watched The Family Man from 2000. So two Nicolas Cages and a Travolta. All Christmas movies in one way or another. The Family Man, surprisingly, the least Christmassy of the bunch.
Yeah, but still Christmassy enough.
Yeah, definitely.
You get into February by the end of it, which is nice. You get it's a little holiday action.
Yeah.
Where it takes you around the world.
And the whole thing is kind of it's a Wonderful Life riff,
yeah,
you know.
Christmas.
So right, exactly. Yeah. Which one do you want to start with?
Let's start with Trapped in Paradise.
All right. The George Gallo classic Trapped in Paradise, Nicolas Cage, John Lovitz and Dana Carvey star as three brothers. Dana Carvey and John Lovitz have both just gotten out of prison. And they con Nicolas Cage, their brother, who manages a restaurant. Shades of Love Light Tonica. That's right. Nothing but salad, baby. They kind of con him into going to this sleepy little Pennsylvania town called Paradise, where they plan to rob a bank because they heard a guy in prison talk about it because his daughter works at a bank. His daughter, played by Madge Amick, Amick, I should say. And so they get to the town, they rob the bank, and then hilarity ensues where they can't get out of the town, basically. And it just so happens that Paradise is just the nicest town you ever want to go to. Everybody is so kind. And that's the plot, really, of Trapped in Paradise.
This is a long comedy.
It's almost 2 hours. Yeah.
Yeah.
Way too long.
It feels it.
Yeah, it really does. Part of that is, I think, because the movie is a little bit shapeless. Like, you don't really get a strong sense of why they can't leave. Like, it's not these huge obstacles that are getting in their way. So it's just kind of meandering.
Like,
yeah, exactly. Or even, Quick Change. Did you ever see Quick Change?
Yeah, yeah.
Quick Change is a great movie where they're trying to get out of New York and they can't. And the movie is constantly telling you, well, here's why they can't. Here are the obstacles that are getting in their way. And Trapped in Paradise is more of just kind of a meandering, like, well, I guess that didn't work out. Let's go over here now. Uh-oh, Dana Carvey fell through the ice. Well, let's get him out. Okay, he's better. Now where should we go? So it feels long because it never really has a plan for where it's going.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's weird. I understood it better, I think, after I read a little bit about the experience making the movie. Because one of the things that I read on the trivia was that, according to John Lovitz, George Gallo didn't direct much of the movie and just told the cast to do whatever they wanted. And that
Nicolas explains Dana Carvey's voice.
Which apparently he based off of Mickey Rourke.
Oh, all right. That kind of makes sense, actually.
It says his facial mannerisms and speaking style are based on a young Mickey Rourke. Which the first time I saw Dana Carvey doing his thing in this, I was just like, oh no.
Yeah, we're in for a long road.
Yeah. And then Lovitz also said that Nicolas Cage actually directed some of the film because George Gallo refused to give direction. Which is a problem if you're the director.
It is a problem, but I like the idea of Nicolas Cage directing.
Yeah, and he's the best part of the movie, not surprisingly, because he has some funny line readings and he's just likable as like a romantic lead.
Yeah, the romance is embarrassingly tacked on. The idea that these two have any romantic chemistry whatsoever is kind of embarrassing. It's really forced, but you're right. I mean, he is kind of the likable leading man, and he does have some hilarious, like, freakouts. I wish I had written it down early on. He does one of his great line deliveries where he pauses after every word, you know, and then shouts the last one. If you see Trapped in Paradise, which is streaming on HBO Max, you'll certainly know the line when you hear it. Yeah, he's definitely the best part. It's a weird period in his career where he was kind of trying to be this kind of leading man, kind of a conventional leading man. This is kind of his guarding test period. And it doesn't quite suit him, you know. Once he continued to make big mainstream movies throughout the 90s, and really even through The Family Man, which we'll get to, but he found the weirdness in those movies. In like, once he gets into action movies, he kind of starts finding the weirdness in them and plays to that, whereas in Trapped in Paradise, he's not really able to. He's just kind of stuck as this, almost playing the straight man, basically, to John Lovitz and Dana Carvey. And I agree, I find him funnier than both of them, although I did think Dana Carvey's weird obsession with, is it scallions or chives?
Scallions. In the gravy or whatever.
More than once, he's very excited about scallions, which I thought was kind of funny.
Yeah, I had that with Dana Carvey too, where, like, you know, I said, I'm like, oh god, like, this is gonna get so grating. Yeah. But then he'll have a line, he's just like, look at that cream corn. And I just like start laughing, or he's just like going on and on about like the giblets and stuff.
Yeah.
Just like, yeah, this is kind of funny. I don't know, it's better than John Lovitz, who I usually think is funnier than most people, but he just seems like openly miserable and they barely give him anything to do in this.
Yeah, he's just kind of the slimeball brother. Who gets them all into trouble by being a liar, but he's never funny, really. I actually think the mom is funnier than both of them.
Yeah. What was she in?
She was the judge on My Two Dads.
That's right. That's right.
They called her Judge. I don't know what her name was on that show. They called her Judge.
I like that their family name in this movie is Firpo. That's a good movie name.
That's pure Gallo gold right there.
Yeah.
It seems, again, part of the problem with like would-be Christmas movies is that they try so hard to be so like feel-good and so warm-hearted. And sometimes you want them to just be a little bit more of like a comedy. Or like, I didn't want it to be darker, you know. I don't need it to be darker. There's plenty of dark Christmas movies, but like the score, which is by Robert Fulk, is incredibly like saccharine, and just wants to remind you that you're watching this feel good Christmas movie so much that it's butting up against what is supposed to be a comedy. Because it's never very funny, and none of their exploits end up being very funny. Again, there's a couple funny line deliveries. I almost wish George Gallo had disappeared even more and let them run rampant and just had them do literally whatever they wanted, because I feel like a weirder movie would have resulted.
Yeah. No, I know what you mean. Yeah, it's like definitely like in that neutral position where it's like too acidic to be like heartwarming, but then it never like really goes for it in terms of like being a dark comedy. So right. It's just sort of like in this weird middle spot that The thing that did keep my interest, though, and like didn't made it so that I wasn't getting too bored with the movie, is that I don't know who shot this. I have to look up the cinematographer, but it looks like Die Hard 2. Like, it's unusually good looking, like, for this type of movie.
This was shot by Jack Green.
That's not Jan de Bont.
He shot Unforgiven.
Jack Green did?
Yeah.
My goodness. So this is like his blank check movie.
And he was, he shot Unforgiven, Rookie of the Year, A Perfect World.
Yeah, it's gorgeous. It's like a really, really good looking movie.
He shot a lot of Clint Eastwood movies. And worked for Jan de Bont a couple times. He shot Twister, and he shot Speed 2 Cruise Control, next year's holiday movie.
He's the Spotlight Showcase below the line member for me on this movie.
It does look great, and the town is cute, you know, and the winter snowy photography is very pleasant. Like, aside from it being long, it's an easy movie for me to watch. This is the second time I watched it this year, because I watched it at the beginning of the year when I was going through like all the Cage movies. And I had already seen it at that point, so this was my third or fourth time seeing Trapped in Paradise. It's an easy movie for me to watch, especially around Christmas time, but it's just not all that good.
Yeah. So Trapped in Paradise, I don't know if I'd recommend it. It wasn't my fave.
No, not my fave either. Was it your least fave of the three that we watched?
Oh, no.
Okay, thank goodness. Thank God.
And this is a movie that has like a real mean streak towards mentally challenged people too.
Oh yeah, boy.
It's weird, but the other movie, Mr. Travolta's contribution, is far more offensive.
Let's get into it. Let's talk about Look Who's Talking Now. Speaking of first time watches, this was my first ever experience with Look Who's Talking Now, which just goes to show that like I really love Look Who's Talking. I saw Look Who's Talking 2 once in the theater at the second run and didn't like it enough that I've never seen it a second time, and just never bothered with Look Who's Talking Now for, you know, over 30 years, basically. I guess close to 30 years, 27 years. And yet, finally, I'm thankful for this podcast because it finally forced me to sit down and watch Look Who's Talking Now, which is, of course, the one where the dogs talk, featuring the unique voice talents of Danny DeVito and Diane Keaton. That's what the little Amazon write-up said, featuring the unique voice talents of Diane. Like, what is unique about Diane Keaton's voice?
Nothing. I mean, they if you said to me, like, what would Danny DeVito voicing a dog be like and what would Diane Keaton voicing a dog be like, I would have guessed this exactly. Like, there is no surprise to any of their performance. It's exactly what you think they'll deliver.
100%. And this, you know, the first movie, we had the great Amy Heckerling previously discussed in our talk about Loser. She wrote and directed the first one. For Look Who's Talking Now, we have the great Tom Ropolewski, director of Madhouse, also starring Kirstie Alley.
Oh, God, I forgot about that movie.
And almost nothing else.
He's
directed very – he made a couple documentaries, but Madhouse and Look Who's Talking Now are basically his only feature directing credits.
Yeah, it was like Nolan and Bale – Ropolewski Alley. I have seen Look Who's Talking Now maybe 15 times.
Good Lord, what are you talking about right now?
I had this weird transference thing in the fall of 94 where I really wanted to see Pulp Fiction, and I couldn't because my parents, even though they let me see some R-rated movies with them in theaters or on video, they wouldn't let me watch Pulp Fiction because they saw it with family friends and they were like, this is, you know, not suitable for like a 12-year-old. So I had to wait. And I kept hearing, you know, I was pretty tapped into like movies and what was going on because I would watch Siskel and Ebert and all that stuff. And I was out of my mind excited about Pulp Fiction. So the closest I could come to approximating Pulp Fiction was watching Reservoir Dogs, which was on Stars, which okay. I watched all the time, and watching Look Who's Talking Now, which had John Travolta.
That's a weird double feature.
Yeah. So I would watch those two basically incessantly for like several months from like October through December of 1994. So I was shocked when I was watching Look Who's Talking Now, how many lines I remembered. And it was stuff like, knock, knock, who's there? Chicken, bawk, bawk, I'm a chicken. And I would remember stuff like that. Or like I would remember like the Charles Barkley cameo and stuff like that. And
that was a good scene.
Yeah, there's so many good scenes in this movie. This has to be the bottom for Travolta. And I thank Quentin Tarantino so much for rescuing his career, because I love John Travolta as an actor. He's a very nice man. However, he needs to be saved from himself sometimes for choices.
Yeah, this really is kind of the bottom for him, right? Because this is the last thing he does before the Pulp Fiction revival.
Yep.
Tarantino saved him from the talking dogs, the unique voice talents of Diane Keaton.
Yeah, not even the trademark sperm credits could save this movie.
Why does this movie need a sperm opening? Like, is that really the hallmark of a Look Who's Talking movie, is that we get to watch sperm, but in this movie it's dog sperm? For some reason, that was upsetting to me.
Yeah, it is gross. Like, I don't know, maybe it was a tribute to Heckerling with, like, Biggs and Suvari's eggs or something. I don't know.
I don't know. In the first movie, it's weird and kind of gross, but I get it.
It's
and
funny,
yeah, it is. And in this movie, I just was like, oh, wait, I'm watching dog sperm fertilize dog eggs. There's something that is uncomfortable about that to me. I don't know why.
Yeah, it was real gross. And this movie, like, I was having fun playing a game during this where I was thinking back, like, what happened in the first act of Look Who's Talking? And then think to yourself, this is going to become a trilogy. And what happens in the last act of Look Who's Talking Now? So in the first act of Look Who's Talking, it's like, there's the stuff with George Segal, and then there's the stuff with Kirstie Alley, and then you introduce John Travolta, and he's a cab driver. And then in the third act of Look Who's Talking Now, there's wolf attacks.
Yeah.
There's Anna is real.
Yeah.
There's the end credits, which deserves its own 5-minute breakout.
We will get there.
Yeah. But yeah, why does this movie turn into The Gray?
It was always planned as a trilogy. It was always working towards Travolta getting that job at the airline.
Yeah.
Working for Lisette Anthony from Krull. She, of course, is the princess in Krull.
She was supposed to be played by Olivia Newton-John, who was sick at the time.
Well, I don't want to see that movie. If I see a movie with Olivia Newton-John and John Travolta, I want to see them as romantic opposites. No, I don't want to see her as the villain.
See, if she was the villain, I would be okay with him breaking it off with Kirstie Alley.
Well, I think all of us are okay with him breaking it off with Kirstie Alley at this point.
Yeah.
Knowing what we know about Kirstie Alley, I'm okay with him never coming to her rescue at the end of the movie and just leaving her to wither in that police station.
And what a horrible mom. She's just like, oh no, there's a snowstorm. Kids, get in the car.
Because I never watched Seventh Heaven, I didn't realize that Mikey was the kid from Seventh Heaven. I knew he looked familiar. Yeah. But I didn't realize that was that kid. And then he grew up to be the kid in the long-haired guy in Super 8, the drugs are so bad guy.
That's true. Yeah. Yeah. He's an upgrade from the kid playing Mikey in Look Who's Talking To.
I don't remember Look Who's Talking To at all because I didn't like it so much.
I remember two things about Look Who's Talking To. One was that they couldn't get the kid not to keep flapping his mouth. So, like, it looked really weird, like this weird dub when Bruce Willis was talking for him. And then I also remember that there was, like, I don't know what that word is. How do you say it? Anthropomorphic.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you. Toilets where Mel Brooks was just like, I want that puppy.
Good. They got the unique voice talents of Mel Brooks.
Yeah. They're like, Mel, we want you to play a toilet, and we want you to scream at a child that you want his poopy. And
where do I sign?
Done.
He's Pacino shouting.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, this movie's not good at all. At all.
It was shockingly bad. And I'm trying not to be too negative because obviously people worked hard on it. I was so distracted by like Travolta's 90s hair and 90s clothes.
Oh my God, the 90s clothes.
They're really bad. Like the jacket with the blue sleeves that are super puffy, or like the blue suit jacket that Lissette Anthony buys him. He looks just bad. He just is not done any favors by the costuming in this movie. And he's not really given a part to play. I mean, either is Kirstie Alley, but she's at least doing like a little bit of a meltdown because she gets fired and she's afraid that John Travolta is cheating on her. But when I think about John Travolta in Look Who's Talking, and he's so charming and he's so likable, and you watch him and you're like, oh man, that's why that guy's a movie star. And he gets to do none of that in this movie. He's just, I mean, he gets to dance. I guess that's good. Because he's a good dancer, so we get to see him dance a couple of times. But beyond that, I just felt like they didn't even give him anything to do.
I feel like he only signed on for this because they said that he could fly in the movie in several scenes. Like, that was, like, the gimme that they were like, okay, you know, we'll throw you a bone. Like, we know you like to fly, so
get
we'll
it.
Put in a lot
throw
of
throw you a
stuff.
Bone. It's Look Who's Talking Now. The dogs Waka, are Waka, talking. Waka. The puppy was
and,
cute.
Like, there is, and there's like ballroom stuff, which is okay just because it's like less terrible than everything else that's in there. But it's weird to have like the central plot of the Look Who's Talking sequel be about a homewrecker trying to like create the family. And especially because there's never any indication that Travolta wants to stray away from his family.
Right.
So it just feels like predatory.
It's just a massive sexual harassment lawsuit waiting to happen. I had my kids watch it with me, which was a mistake because I had never seen it before, and there's all this stuff about Santa not being real, and I was like, oh shit, where's this movie gonna come down? And I kind of assumed like it'll come back around on Santa is real because it's a movie and that's what movies do. I wish I had written down some of their quotes. Like, I know my daughter is dog crazy, and so she liked watching the dogs, and she referred to them as the street dog and the fancy dog. And then my son turned to me at one point and said, if this movie was about anything else, it would be good. Which I don't even know what he means, but he's right. If it was about anything else, it would be good.
Yeah. That's like when people say, oh, I can't make your party. I got to do anything else right now.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
If this movie was about anything else, it would be good.
Yeah. Yeah, it's – and then it ends with like a supernatural element because Santa Claus is on the CV radio.
Right? What? Well, that's not how it ends. It ends even more supernatural than that because the children – are shrunk down to miniature size and placed in a dollhouse to take part in the weirdest French music video. Like, what is happening? I know you had said something about the end credits and how I needed to stay and watch all the end credits, but like when the film stock changed, I thought, well, that's weird. What's going on? Why is this a different film stock? And then it turned into a music video. What's that? Yeah, with a little kid French rapper who doesn't seem to know the words to his own song.
His name is Jordy.
It is.
And he was famous. I knew of Jordy because he did some like song called Ooh La La Baby. And like it was one of the music videos they made fun of on Beavis and Butthead.
Oh, wow.
And I put it out of my mind for 27 years. And I never thought that, and for some reason, I think it's just because, like, you know how sometimes, like, trauma victims block out, like, past tragedies? Like, sure. I did not remember this end credits, even though I've seen this movie maybe 15 times. But, yeah, he's singing, It's Christmas, Say Noel.
Yeah.
And, yeah, like you said, there's these children that are shrunk down, and the movie, this film stock looks like Canadian exploitation horror from the 80s.
Yeah.
And then like John Travolta and like Kirstie Alley are like trying to find their children inside of a dollhouse.
Yeah.
And then the movie ends and nobody can put that. Like, I would almost love to be in an audience for this in November 1993 and then just turn to people and be like, well, that was a choice.
I assume people were just dancing up the aisles to It's Christmas, Say Noel.
Yes.
And you'd have to grab one of them from their joyous rapture at having just watched Look Who's Talking Now. They're all tuckered out from having laughed for 90 straight minutes. And then you have to point out to them that you realize those kids are trapped in that dollhouse forever now, right?
Yeah, well, naturally. I mean, that's how dollhouses work.
Santa is observing the whole thing, just laughing like some bizarre puppet master.
Yeah, I remember that this movie, when it was at the Dollar Theater in Des Plaines, it was on a double bill with RoboCop 3. And imagine watching the end credits to Look Who's Talking Now, and then you go straight into RoboCop 3.
RoboCop 3, better movie.
Yeah, yeah, probably. I haven't seen it, but I would assume that it is.
It is. Although that is a real shit sandwich of a double feature.
Yeah, yeah. I still want to watch it, though.
Yeah. No, I don't even hate RoboCop 3. I mean, there's stuff in RoboCop 3 that I like, but just in terms of, like, how far we've fallen, that is quite the double bill of, like, oh, these sequels probably, these part threes shouldn't have been made because the first movies are great.
Mm-hmm. I'm surprised that John Travolta's only been in one Christmas movie. He feels like the type of guy who would have been in, like, seven of them.
He could have played Santa in the Christmas Chronicles.
Did you see that he's a Santa in a Capital One commercial with Samuel L. Jackson this year?
I haven't seen that commercial, but there. Should we talk about that?
We can, yeah. Should we talk about the Welcome Back, Kotter Christmas episode?
We could. I know he's in the video for It's Christmas, Say Noel.
Yeah. Have you ever listened to him and Olivia Newton-John's Christmas album that came out a few years ago?
I have not, no.
There's a music video for a song called, I forgot what it's called. Like, I don't know. I don't remember, but it's tough. It's a tough watch.
Oh, bummer.
But here's a join to our last movie.
Yeah.
John Travolta was originally supposed to be set to star in The Family Man.
No kidding. Why did he back out?
He probably was doing Battlefield Earth.
Oh, boy.
I don't know.
I could see him in The Family Man. I think he'd be good in The Family Man.
I think so, too. I think Nicolas Cage is really good in it, though. So
Nicolas Cage rules in The Family Man.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to trade that. Speaking of Nicolas Cage rules, I wrote a holiday song about Nicolas Cage, and I was wondering if you wanted to hear it.
I feel like there's nothing I'd rather hear right now.
Okay. All right, 1 second. Let me take a sip of water. All right, the bitch is ready. Let's go. Okay. Cameron Poe going home. Caster Troy switches. Matchstick men, weatherman, vampire kisses. A score to settle and more DTVs. These are a few of the cages I've seen. Leaving Las Vegas, but drinking in oodles. 8mm had snuff and caboodles. In the Dominic Senna, he played Memphis Reigns. These are some more of the cages I've seen. Snowden was golden when this actor passes. He might have done Trespass to pay off his taxes. Ghost Rider was winter, next came out in spring. I lied, these aren't all cages I've seen. Fast Times Ridgemont High, Kiss of Death's all right. VX Poison Gas. When I remember the cages I've seen, I know Patrick is so glad.
Yay! That was awesome.
I'm taking a bow. Thank you.
You absolutely should. That was very, very entertaining. Very well done.
Play that in front of the cardboard cutout and let me know what his reaction is.
The cardboard cutout is literally next to me right now.
Yeah. All right.
He's watching
Santa
me.
There?
Is who there?
The Santa Chucky?
I didn't bring Santa Chucky out this year. I would have if you were coming over, but it's quarantine.
Yeah, I gotcha.
Makes sense. Yeah. That song was awesome. Thank you for making this a very special holiday episode.
Well, I had to put a button on it like Jordy, so. The Family Man was better this time than it's ever been for me. And I've always kind of liked The Family Man, but I love The Family Man this time.
Yeah, I'm in the love camp too. I've pretty much loved it since I double featured this in December 2000 with Castaway, which was a pretty sweet day at the movies.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And this is also the second time I've watched Family Man this year, because again, I rewatched it when I was on my Cage Jag earlier in the year. But yeah, no, I love The Family Man. This is like a staple for me.
Yeah, it's really good. I remember another one that I was like really excited for when it came out, and it was also in that period of time, like with You've Got Mail and 2 Weeks Notice, where it made like going into the business world seem like the greatest thing ever. And the beginning of The Family Man, like, I know that the lesson was, you know, follow the girl, like that's the key to the happy life. But like, I was like, you're not doing a good job of selling me against the life of the businessman at the beginning, because it looks pretty good. But I remember, you know, because I was in business school at that time, I was just like, I've got a lot to look forward to.
Erica took offense to him telling Amber Valletta she's a terrific lover. Like, that's not something, because it's just not something you say to somebody the morning after you've hooked up.
That is true. Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe it is. I have limited experience.
What you do is you say, get on the phone, call your friends and family, and say that you've taken a lover and that you'll be back in a week.
That I like a lot better.
That's what you do. Yeah. That's romance.
Yeah.
That's also what they do in Love Lights Hanukkah, because they're all in each other's business.
Because they only know 5 people.
This is true. Guaca, guacalaca.
Guacalaca, chocolaca. Yeah.
He's just like, I'd love to see you again, Amber Valletta. And she's just like, I'll bring the guacalacas.
Your lasagna is predictable. Lasagna laca.
Whoa.
Yeah, see, that's that. Now that would have paid everything off if at the end of the movie she's like, here, lasagna laca. It's unpredictable, and it celebrates my Jewish heritage, and it actually pays off something from earlier in the movie. But that didn't happen.
The Latka Coda, the death of Guacalaca.
This is why I need to be a Hollywood script doctor.
This is true.
Yeah.
I have a theory about The Family Man before we get into The Family Man.
I would love to hear this theory.
I think that the movie is part of the Conjuring universe.
Interesting. Not what I expected.
Taya Leone's parents are named Ed and Lorraine.
Okay.
Just like Ed and Lorraine Warren.
Right.
And this came out in 2000.
Yeah.
And they're about 60-something years old.
Oh, my goodness. And the tire shop is a front.
Yes. And then Patrick Wilson and Vera Farmiga are probably in their 30s, in the 70s, in the Conjuring universe. Mm-hmm. So Taya Leone's parents are Ed and Lorraine Warren.
Wow.
Because we don't know what her last name – or no, they do say what her last name is.
Right? Damn, I think they, yeah.
I don't know if it's her maiden name, yeah, which I think they do. But all right, I'm going to go with it. I'm still going to say that.
I like seeing Harv Presnell show up as Big Ed.
Yeah, he's always like one of those character actors I'm happy to see.
What do you think they're doing at McDonald's? They're not drinking milkshakes, I'll tell you that.
Oh, good time.
Good times. So The Family Man rules. Nicolas Cage is an extremely successful, wealthy businessman who tells an angel one night he has everything, the angel played by Don Cheadle, because he gave up the love of his life to go to London and be successful in business. So Don Cheadle says, well, then I'll give you a glimpse. And he wakes up and he's living the life that could have been, the road not traveled, where he's living in the suburbs of New Jersey, and he works at his father-in-law's tire store, and he's married to Taya Leone, and they have 2 kids. And he learns what it's like to have love in his life, basically. And then it ends on kind of a melancholy note, which I give it so much credit for.
Did you read that as melancholy?
A little bit. I mean, I know it's hopeful because it's the two of them having coffee together, but it's the whole sequence where he has to say goodbye, where he knows that he's going to wake up the following morning. It's so sad where he's like saying goodbye to the kids and he's trying to stay awake for as long as he can because he doesn't want to give up what he has now. And it doesn't just automatically say that, like, okay, him and Tay Leone are going to get back together, right? It says they're going to have coffee together and we'll see where it goes from there. But so it's hopeful, but I always think the ending is a little bit melancholy, yeah.
I don't know. For me, like, and maybe I'm just reading too much into it, like, visually, like, because there's a whole, like, motif of when he's about to go into, like, this other world, there's snow.
Yeah.
Otherwise, there's no snow.
Right.
Like, snow falling. And at the end of the movie, when you look outside the window, the snow is falling during, like, the scene where they're having coffee.
Yeah.
But then it, like, clears. So it's just like, oh, okay, this is this new reality. And I don't know, like, the only thing that kind of bugs me a little bit about the ending is that I feel like it still falls into the, you have to give up something.
Oh, sure.
To get
something. Yeah, you can't have it all.
You can't have it all, which I think when it comes to, you know, happily ever after, like with, you know, romance and then also with like a career that you like, you can have both of them. And
right.
I think it's sort of, I mean, maybe it's not dramatic to say that, but the scene that sticks out to me, even though it doesn't really work for this to be the ending because it's Tay Leone making the sacrifice and not Nicolas Cage, and that's the whole point, is when she says, you know, I know you love this job and I'll move to New York with you because I believe in us and that's what matters. And no matter, as long as we're together, that's all that matters to me. And it's just like, I think that is the most romantic gesture of the movie as opposed to kind of the speech at the end at the airport.
Sure. Tay Leone is absolutely the MVP of this movie, I think.
Yeah, she's really good.
As much as I love Cage in this movie, she's so good. She's so good at creating such a familiarity with him, such a shorthand, at being awesome in a way that isn't calling attention to, like, what a great wife she is, right? Because a lot of movies try so hard to play up the perfect spouse. And she's not perfect in movie terms, but she's just so, so great. And the way that she talks to him, there's such a familiarity with him. And it has to happen because we're in the Nicolas Cage role where we're waking up in this strange new world with him. We're getting dropped in. So for her to do that in such a short amount of time goes so far towards establishing we know exactly what their life really is. Right away, and she's so good at doing that. I just can't say enough good things about her.
Yeah, I think this is my favorite performance of hers by far.
Mine too, because I'm not always like a huge Tay Leone fan. It's not her fault necessarily, but she's given parts like Jurassic Park 3 or Spanglish where she has to be kind of awful, and it's nice to see her not be awful, just to see her be kind of wonderful. But again, not wonderful in this movie, like, cookie-cutter perfect way. Wonderful in a very human way, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's also, like, she has to live up to it in her performance, too, because, like, the script set up where, like, all the other characters are jealous of her and, like, what her and Nicolas Cage have. And it's, like, not something... It's something that you believe, and then, but it's also not obnoxious, where you're just like,
exactly.
As well. It's just like, So I really like that a lot. I also like that, although, you know, I mean, like, it involves like hostile takeovers and like there's kind of dirty elements to his business. I do like that they stick with the whole movie pretty much that. He like really loves his job and his lifestyle, and it's not something necessarily that he should apologize for. So I don't know, maybe I'm reading that differently than you are, but like I appreciate the sense that it's not just completely demonizing like his life as opposed to, you know, this is the real life, this small town charm, and so to speak.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, the notion that, like, you can't have it all is true for this Nicolas Cage, I guess, but, like, you never get an indication that the Nicolas Cage whose place he's taking was unhappy in any way. You never get, no one ever indicates that, like, oh, that Nicolas Cage resents working at the tire store. That Nicolas Cage always wished he could have been in business. There's no talk of that. So he could be perfectly happy doing what he's doing, you know?
Yeah, as long as, like, his boss didn't show up, like, he probably could have gone on.
Right, like, right.
At the tire store, yeah.
Right. So I don't know that it doesn't necessarily demonize that other lifestyle, but it does say he doesn't need it.
That's true. Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know.
I also like the him and the daughter have, because so, like, a worse movie would have really stretched it out where she, like, suspects something's off, but, like, she doesn't say it until the third act.
Right.
And we kind of just drag out this, like, BS that the audience is, like, five steps ahead of. And, like, in this, like, they do it pretty early on. And I think it's funny that, like, her big concern is that she thinks that he's going to put, like, worms in her and her brother's brain. And that's the big thing. It's such, like, a kid detail. So, I don't know. I thought that their scenes were cute, and I like that they got that plot contrivance kind of out of the way early.
It really is, like, the best possible version of this movie, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's funny, too, because, like, I think when I saw this, I maybe had seen It's a Wonderful Life. I'm not sure if I had yet. But I think I thought that It's a Wonderful Life was the Family Man. Like, the whole movie was the scenario.
I think I always thought that too until I saw it.
Yeah, and it's cool to see it stretched out as a feature length film, although it is just kind of a Christmas Carol in some ways.
Yeah, when I said it was the best possible version of this movie, I didn't mean, like, the best possible It's a Wonderful Life, because obviously It's a Wonderful Life is the best possible version of It's a Wonderful Life. I just mean, like, this script, I think, is really well realized by everyone involved. And we should probably talk for a minute about Brett Ratner. I know he's canceled and he's a scumbag.
Yeah.
Is this his best movie?
Yeah, because I think I like it more than Rush Hour at this point.
I just so appreciate, and I always said this about Brett Ratner, and I always knew he was a douche. I didn't know the extent to which he was a douche, or, you know, it was a scumbag, basically. But I always appreciated that he surrounds himself with really talented people. And so I think something like The Family Man really benefits from not just having, like, a real first-rate cast, but by having, like, Danny Elfman do the score or Dante Spinotti shoot the movie. Like, he really always surrounded himself with true talent, and that always made him look good, you know? So I never bought into the notion that Brett Ratner was a bad director. He was always listed as one of these hacks, and I have never thought that, because I liked a lot of the movies that he made. I even like Red Dragon to an extent. I don't love it, but, like, I think he surrounded himself with really good people when he made that movie.
Yeah, I like Red Dragon also. Yeah, yeah. It's one of those things where it's like, yeah, it's a bummer because he's such a shitbag, but, like,
yeah, for sure.
You can also say, on the other hand, he did make some good movies, and I think this is his best one.
It's probably my favorite of his as well, and not just because it's got, you know, a Nicolas Cage movie star performance. And I think this is better than, like, a Trapped in Paradise. I think because of the material is better, obviously, than Trapped in Paradise. It asks more of Nicolas Cage than something like Trapped in Paradise. But also there's something kind of meta about Nicolas Cage starring, you know, it's sort of a conventional movie star part. That's why I could see John Travolta fitting very well in this kind of a movie. But Nicolas Cage feeling out of place a little bit because he wants to be weirder and more eccentric, and he wants to do weird things and take chances, but he's stuck conforming in this conventional Hollywood product. And there's something, I think, like this meta commentary going on about the movie itself. But I don't think he plays to any of that. I don't think he's ever... I think he does exactly what the script wants him to do. And that's always been, you know, I've never seen him intentionally tank a movie, with the exception of something like Peggy Sue Got Married, where he's not trying to tank a movie. He's just doing something that maybe didn't work. He's doing Dana Carvey in Trapped in Paradise, basically. Doing Mickey Rourke. But like, so I like that as this being the story of Nicolas Cage, the actor, feeling out of place in a movie like this. But I think he plays the part really, really well. I think he's really, really great in the movie.
Yeah, and I think like the quirkiness and like unconventional aspect of him works really well when he's playing like the New Jersey dad fantasy version, also because he's sort of a fish out of water, and like he's allowed to like have just kind of these asides. Like I really like when Taya Leone's like trying to like seduce him, and she takes off his socks and he's like, please leave my socks alone. And it's just such like a weird line that you probably think that he came up with off the cuff, but it's funny. And it's like, it gives like sort of a characterization, just like, it's not just that he's irritated. It's like, that's a specific thing that he's irritated about, is that like, I wanted those socks on. And then I like that, you know, when he almost cheats with the neighbor woman, like he seems kind of like really like excited about it. And it's sort of not what you expect. It's just a weird kind of quirky choice that fits him in a role. So I like the spontaneity and like kind of the unpredictable nature that he can kind of bring to a straight part. Like
yes,
this.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
No, he's great.
I do take umbrage with Don Cheadle for not giving Nicolas Cage kind of an executive brief before going into this situation, because I don't think that's really fair to his wife and kids. If you kind of explain to him like, hey, this is what's going on with you in this other world, like he probably wouldn't have been like such a shit to them at a certain point. So I don't really get that beat of the movie, because like, you know, I have to write executive briefs for much less at work, and like it's kind of a big deal.
So let me ask you a question. Does this dimension, does this side universe continue to exist after Nicolas Cage leaves it?
I think so. Yeah. Okay. Because the other universe existed while he was in New Jersey. It's just with Saul Rubinek. So, yeah, I think like there's some kind of like a dual Cage thing there, where like he's still the guy, the New Jersey dad.
But when he comes back, no time has passed.
See, now you got me in Tenet territory, and I don't know. But
he's been inverted the whole time.
I don't know. I just dig on multiverses, man. Just dig on him. I like to think that, you know, in the scene where he's watching the birthday video and he sings La 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 Means I Love You by the Delfonics, I'd like to think that he had just watched Jackie Brown and is like, I've got an idea.
I'm sure he just watched Jackie Brown.
The timing is right. That came out in 97. This came out in 2000.
Yeah.
So it would have been on cable rotation. So I think that could have happened.
I cannot believe this movie's 20 years old.
Yeah, I know. It's crazy. What if this is like a glimpse for Piven also from his Judgment Night character?
So if Ray didn't rent the RV, he might be living in the suburbs with Kate Walsh.
Yeah, yeah. And then like Cage is like, let me be your consigliere. Don't rent the RV.
Don't rent the RV. Piven's good in the movie.
He is. I don't like the line about people giving up their left nut to be with Kate.
Right.
Because it just seems like a, I don't know, it just seems like a kind of hacky line. But like,
well, and it is the movie trying too hard to sell us on how great Kate is, even though we're watching the movie. We see how great Kate is. We don't need to be told by Jeremy Piven.
Yeah, this is true. But yeah, good on him. He's with Kate Walsh, who Liam Neeson loves in Honest Thief, so I get it.
A movie I don't believe exists.
It barely did. Only in theaters. I think that the cake scene should be in permanent rotation as a Portillo's commercial.
Okay.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Yeah, you just, yeah, cake shakes, Portillo's cake, eat on the stairs, make out. That's what it's all about.
I like it.
This movie's got a Seal song in the end credits. So, I mean, like, every good movie has a Seal song.
Yeah, you know, that kind of broke the spell for me, honestly. I was willing to just have the Danny Elfman score play over the end credits. I don't like when, sometimes I love when a song kicks in, but in this case, I did not.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's The Family Man, my favorite of the three movies that we discussed, and kind of a Christmas staple for me, I would say.
I think it's going to become a Christmas staple for me.
It's a good one, man.
Really good.
Yeah.
If in the year 2000, it would have been number 2, number 10, an honorable mention. One of those three.
But that's going to wrap up our annual holiday episode. Adam, as always, thank you for doing this with me. It's one of my favorite shows to do all year, and this year was no exception.
Thanks. Yeah, I want to do a quick holiday shout out to a few people, if that's okay.
Absolutely.
Happy holidays to Harry Renard. I hope you unload that Ferrotech IPO on the open market and get your family back. I want to say thank you and happy holidays to the law offices of Buttwater and Meat Puppets.
What?
Mystery Girl. That was from the Tales from the Hood 3 episode. happy holidays to the Mystery Girl from Veronica.
Oh, Mystery Girl.
What you're looking for. Happy holidays to Amy the Gorilla. And happy holidays to John Gotti. No one did it better than you. And thank you for taking care of the neighborhood.
Couldn't have said it better myself. Happy holidays to all of our fabulous listeners. Hope you guys all have a great holiday season and that you all stay safe and healthy and happy and that you get to watch some movies. Thanks again, Adam.
Thank you.
Happy holidays, everybody. Ho, ho, ho.
Christmas.